Well, hi and welcome. I hope you guys are all doing great. I really appreciate the questions and comments that many of you have sent in. They will help guide some of our discussion and really ensure that this is going to really address some things that are important and relevant for you. And some of the things cluster around providing information. And I just want to comment on that before we move into our topic. And I want to encourage you to add or ask and jump in at any point. Now, many of you have heard me say, if information was enough, we'd all exercise every day, eat mostly vegetables, be thin, have a lot of money saved up for the future, and a lot of librarians would be billionaires. Now, facts are not the way we change mind. We think about marketing as tending to focus on information about, for example, how much healthier teens would be if they didn't smoke or if they eat more vegetables, thinking that if you lay down the facts in a clear, intelligent, concise way, that's going to tip the scales, that the audience, the intended audience, will pay attention, will weigh the information and act accordingly. But is that what really motivates people to act? No. Think about your last online search. Why was it important? Was it to find information quickly, or as it was something more important to you than getting answers? And why did you want those answers? Is it possibly to connect with other people like you who want to achieve goals like yours, maybe even fulfill dreams like yours? That's an emotional foundation. That's the beginning of figuring out how someone cares. And think about right now our situation. When faced with death on contracting the coronavirus, why have over 40% of Americans refused to get fully vaccinated, even after knowing that over 99% of the deaths from the Delta variant are those unvaccinated? Facts as well as beliefs are anatomical realities in our brains. You don't create a change by suddenly introducing a new idea and expect it to override the one that's already there. Facts, logic, information are simply not powerful tools to alter opinion. So you don't want to start talking to somebody about what professional coaching can do. Data is not a way to change minds. It's simply not how we decide. And think about it in this way. People regard information as valid when it reinforces their existing views. This is how arguments more staunchly solidify someone's original position, because someone with information that contradicts an opinion causes that person to generate new counterarguments and further strengthen their view. That's the boomerang effect. The result, people grow more confident in their initial convictions and use information to further polarize opinions, whether it's abortion, gun control, climate change, vaccination, whatever. So whenever we hear a point of view or information, we quickly, without maybe even being conscious about it, scan for evidence that confirms what we already believe, and we assess information with a critical, disbelieving eye. If it doesn't fit what we believe, then we cherry-pick information to fortify our beliefs, not even often being consciously aware of it. And that's where the boomerang effect comes in. Some recent studies have shown that the more intelligent, the more psychologically flexible someone is, the more quickly and ably they will be able to counter what they hear if it's not fitting with what they believe. So how do you catalyze change? Think about what that means for you and your practice. Here's a story that I want to tell you. A video showed someone described as plump and matronly who walked onto a stage. Consensus was that she, quote, looked more like a lunch lady than a vocalist and was, quote, too old to be competing on Britain's Got Talent, Some of you know this already. At 47, she was more than twice the age of many of the other contestants. Judges asked her questions that she got stuck on and stumbled on her words. The camera zoomed in on members of the audience laughing, rolling their eyes, and the judges kind of smirking. All signs pointed to her being booted from the show. When it seemed that things couldn't get any worse, she started singing. Time stopped. It was breathtaking. The opening chords of I Dreamed a Dream from Les Miserables came over the speakers. Her exquisite voice was so powerful that it captivated the judges and the audience and inspired awe. The audience screamed. Everyone broke into wild applause. Some started even tearing up as they listened. The performance left people speechless. Susan Boyle's appearance in 9 days accumulated more than 100 million views. Sharing emotions helps us connect. Emotions help deepen social connection. Highlights, can I get a mute? Everybody on mute unless you're ready to talk because there's techno static that you're not hearing. It highlights our similarities and reminds us of how much we have in common. The experience of sharing an emotion creates a tremendous bond. So that's what you want to think about in terms of connecting with a potential client. It's not about, as was very well put, chasing leads and playing hit or miss with ads. It's not about offering new material or convincing information. It's about how do you connect with somebody? Remember the circle and the stick figure. How do you resonate with someone's experience, their primary challenge, to enter that circle so that you can begin on common ground of looking together at finding something that that person can't do or be themselves? That's what they'll pay you for. So we're going to explore more about that and apply that in a more specific way, but I wanted to mention that because there's some good questions that clustered around this idea about information versus something else and looking at it in a proactive way of resonating with someone rather than a reactive way of responding to any number of things. So other comments, thoughts, or questions that you have at this point or any just check-ins from anybody? Again, I very much appreciate all the comments. Yes, go ahead, please.
Oh, no, just checking in from Saugus, my official assistant, Miriam.
Welcome. Hey, how are you?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Great. Doing super. Super. Thank you. Any questions or additions or things that you want to comment about or even touch on from last time about something that grabbed you or seemed important to you that you want to highlight out loud to the group? Anyone?
I'd like to say,
David, Carlene from
Yeah, hey, go
Canada.
Ahead, Carlene.
Hi, thank you. What I'd like to touch on is this statement, emotions shared creates a bond. And what I'm struggling with is with respect to some of the courses I'm taking, there seems to be this idea that if you're super hyped, that's a sales tactic. And I'm not super hyped. I feel like actually irritated when I'm in environments like that.
Okay.
And so I'm just wondering your take on that.
Can you put in three words why you're irritated? Three words.
I feel controlled.
Okay. The person who wants to get you to join them in a hyped-up mood does not resonate with your experience, so they come across as over-the-top or hyped up, and you just want to let them go. And you know, you want to, you know, hang up or disengage and go for a run. So I think that's really important because empathically resonating with someone's experience means that the entire experience of the person you're resonating with is the point of reference. You want to resonate with what that person is thinking, feeling, experiencing, what their primary challenges are, and then in a little bit of a broader context to know where their ecosystems are, where their watering holes are, where you're going to cross paths with them, who are the referral sources. So you want to know as much about them, but they're the point of reference, not you trying to torque them up and get them to sign on for something that they may or may not need. So your experience is the best answer to that. So that's the reason it won't work for you to do that. Mm-hmm. It won't work for anybody who experiences what you did, and that was very well put.
Thank you.
Thank you for bringing that up. That's so important. There was someone else who spoke at the same time as Carlene. Would you go ahead, please?
I was just checking in. My name is Benita Tyler.
Okay, welcome, Benita. Yeah.
Thank you.
Super. Any other questions or any other things to touch on or highlight before we move into our material? Okay, well, hold on. I'll put us on lecture mode, and I'll reserve some time at the end. So if there are any questions or comments, jot them down, and we'll be back. Okay, we're going to talk about the neuroscience of persuasion. So, a quiz. Ohio State University studied several hundred undergraduates and asked them to rate how much they wanted and liked various pleasurable activities. Here are five multiple choices: receiving a paycheck, seeing a best friend, engaging in sexual activity, receiving a compliment or getting a good grade, eating a favorite food. And this, remember, was Ohio State University undergraduates. And there's a hint here. One of these was endorsed as much as the other four combined. Jot down your answer. We'll come back to that. Persuasion is simply an active process of choice architecture to get someone, to get a prospect, to clearly associate a desired feeling and outcome with your service or product. So, the most significant thing that great persuaders understand and communicate is this. It's not about you, it's about them. Think about that hyped up guy. It was all about him. And remember your primary question. What is it you want to accomplish through this? When President Abraham Lincoln was a successful lawyer prior to his presidency, he began presenting a case by establishing a positive frame for him and his clients that created a distinct advantage. He would begin his opening arguments by summing up the other side's case. He would point out the positive aspects of their position, how worthy of consideration they were, and established his credibility by demonstrating that he recognized the other side had a legitimate view, presented his client's side in detail. People then listened carefully because his credibility was high. The judge and jury both concluded that if he were so willing to give credibility to the viewpoint of the other side, he must be honest and speaking from his heart. This frame of respect and understanding of the other person's point of view establishes a common ground, a connection before presenting your position. So let's talk now about persuasion science. Our aversion to loss is hardwired. We learn more quickly from pain than from pleasure because negative stimuli get more attention and response. Avoiding loss has kept us alive. If you have a chance, review my archived blog, The Allure of Chaos. And I'm sure all of you went to read the one about the Zygarnik effect from last time, so you know where the blog is. Daniel Kahneman won a Nobel Prize by demonstrating that notions of loss are more powerful than a focus on gain. He demonstrated that we register twice as much pain from losing $100 than the pleasure from gaining $100. So we have a loss aversion. This means that people are more emotionally concerned with not making a bad decision than with making the best decision. From psychology and social neuroscience, we know the twin forces of motivation that drive all human behavior: the desire to avoid pain, the desire to seek pleasure. These two organizing principles of brain wiring to minimize danger or pain, to maximize reward or pleasure, are overarching. If we associate positive emotions or reward, we approach. If we associate negative emotions or pain, we avoid. Meaning, if someone buys, they associate more pleasure to buying than not buying. If someone doesn't buy, they associate more pain to buying than not buying. And we process the pleasure and the pain cues unconsciously within a fifth of a second. Here's a master formula of persuasion: to associate buying with getting pleasure and not buying with pain. Greater gain with action, loss with failure to act. Now, since people will do more to avoid pain than to seek pleasure, both avoiding pain and inertia, meaning remaining in the status quo, not changing, are two innate brain tendencies to be aware of. Short-term equals pain. Giving up their money, for example. Most people tend to think long-term to be successful. So think about how much of what we do is to prevent pain: paying bills, doing taxes, exercising, maintaining your house and car. Our brains are wired to prevent pain, to prioritize survival over improvement. It's been important in evolutionary terms, these two basic motivations: to achieve pleasure and to avoid pain. This means that our brains are primarily a mechanism for survival rather than designed for success, fulfillment, and growth. So now let's apply this pain-pleasure brain formula to the three story components. The three components of every story: the challenge, the development, the resolution. Think about a coaching session as a story. Every coaching session has these three components: the challenge, you ask the client what they are most challenged by, what they want to focus on; the development, you collaboratively co-create; and the resolution, the client summarizes in a sentence, hopefully, what they're taking away and what they commit to. So the challenge is to find the need or the interest that's not fulfilled, what your prospects want but they're not getting. The development, show how to meet the challenge. And the resolution, clarify both the emotional and logical reasons to act. Now, keep these three story components in mind. We're going to come back to look at how do you make the best, in my view, recommendation for your professional coaching services using this story formula. Now, people want emotionally, but they justify logically. They think they're being logical when they've already made the decision emotionally. So find the emotional motivators to have or to be the best for their clients, to have the best relationship, the best skill set, to be fully informed, to be confident. Now, part of persuasion focuses on avoiding pain. If you focus on the price, this adds to the pain rather than alleviating it. We keep things to avoid the regret we would experience in giving them up, and that includes our money. Participants in a research study were given a lottery ticket and then asked if they would trade their ticket for a different one with an equal chance of winning. Less than half of the participants agreed, even when they were bribed by chocolate. When the experiment was repeated with pins instead of lottery tickets, 90% of participants agreed to trade. Pins are tangible and real. Lottery tickets are a story of hope. Dopamine for a dollar. People hang on to lottery tickets to hope for the best and avoid the regret they would experience if they had switched and their ticket had won. From a marketing perspective, giving someone $100 to be applied toward a future purpose is a greater incentive than a $100 discount. Think about your experiences in purchasing. Consumer psychology tells us that people will gravitate toward purchasing decisions that do one of these things or more. Reduce the fear of making a mistake. Make them feel more in control. Simplify the decision process. Offer clear, simple, immediate emotional benefits. And eliminate obstacles. So, let's look at the six principles of persuasion. Persuasion appeals to deeply rooted human responses of mind and brain, strategies that simply inform people about facts and reasons to make changes have a high likelihood of failure. And as we've just discussed, information does not lead people to make decisions. So, the mind and brain sciences can tremendously inform persuasion to determine decisions and results. How information is communicated can dramatically affect how it's perceived and acted on. The first principle of persuasion, liking. We like people who like us, who are similar to us in some way. We buy from people we like. We prefer to say yes to people we know, like, and trust. The application, find something in common. Discover real similarities, genuine connection, and offer authentic comments. Think about your last experience where liking someone was in the foreground and what that did to your decision-making process. When I was about 8 years old, it was time to buy a new coat for school. I went to the big city close to the little town where I lived on a farm. We looked at coats in three stores because that's all there were. Penny's, Sears, and Monkey Ward's. Don't even ask about that. But at one store, I really liked the salesman. He was warm, engaging, funny, and seemed to take a genuine interest in me. The coat I was looking at there was a light blue soft velour with an elastic bottom, sort of a balloon effect. You pretty much had to be there. He said, "Man, you look really good in that coat." Nobody had ever told me I looked good in a coat before. I knew right then that was a coat I was going to buy. I just had to convince my mom. I emphasized to my mom how much I wanted that coat. I didn't particularly like the coat, but I sure liked the guy. I liked the coat even less when I got home. That salesman had done a splendid job. I could not grow out of that coat fast enough. For 3 years, every time it got cold, I had vague memories of a really nice salesman. Well, I looked like my head was on top of a light blue marshmallow. So, here's an application that I'm calling the Magic Johnson Principle. When my son and daughter began playing basketball in grade school and I was coaching their teams, I got season tickets for the Houston Rockets, two seats, and they would each do a draft at the beginning of the season to pick who went to what game with me, and we'd have dinner before the game. When the Lakers were in town, they were each excited about seeing Magic Johnson when it was their turn. Before the game began, I gave them each a quiz. Notice how he plays. See what you can pick up about what his strategy is, especially about how he relates to everybody on the court. So after the game, I would ask each of them what they noticed and to not tell the other who was home the answer. No trouble with that. They each mentioned how Magic seemed to be great friends with everybody on the court, including the opposing team players. What else, I asked? And the referees. Anything else I nudged? They each mentioned some aspect of how much they were surprised that he actually fouled. And he never seemed to be called for the foul. We had great seats, so we could see right there with the action. But he was never called for the fouls. Exactly. Everybody on the court likes him. All the players on both sides and the referees really liked him. And he seemed genuinely to like them. He was an expert at handling relationships as much as he was at handling the ball. and they hardly ever called a foul on him. They participated in his success. They would be less likely to feel that they participated in that success if they just had to disrupt the flow of that feeling and call a foul and all that good energy experience that was there when they didn't. In his entire NBA career, Magic only fouled out of 5 games. Unprecedented. When people like you and sense that you have something in common, they're more likely to say yes. It's the law of attraction in action. People essentially do business with and refer business to those who they like, know, and trust. And we've talked about that in a different context. That's the lowest hanging fruit, the relationships that you already have. People commit not to things, but to people who they believe care about them and they care about. So what are the factors that cause one person to like another person? They're not all visible. So neuroscience can help us here. 4 of the most common, there are several, but these are 4 of the most common, just for you to think about. The halo effect. A halo effect occurs when one positive characteristic of a person dominates the way that person is viewed by others. Examples are kindness, honesty, intelligence. We're always teaching people how to respond to us. Another, similarity. We like people who are similar to us, similar backgrounds, interests, age, religion, politics. Roger Dooley, author of Brainfluence, talked about this when he was the expert content contributor at my mastermind group and illustrated it by pointing out how I used something I knew we personally had in common in my introduction of him. A third, compliments. The greatest car salesman in the world, by common consensus, Joe Girard, said that the secret of success was mutually liking clients. Each month, he sent every one of his more than 13,000 former clients a greeting card and a personal message. And the message always contained, "I like you." And people who knew him said that he authentically meant it and they felt it. And a fourth, contact and cooperation. Things that are familiar to us are most likely to persuade. By providing people with different backgrounds, with more exposure to one another as equals, they come to like each other and know each other better. Mr. Rogers carried in his wallet a statement that said, "Frankly, there isn't anyone you couldn't learn to love once you've heard their story." We are wired to socially connect with others. A study in Edinburgh planted hundreds of wallets on city streets. The wallets contained 1 of 4 possible photos: smiling baby, cute puppy, happy family, elderly couple. Other wallets had no photo at all. The percent of wallets that were returned, with the baby photo, 88%. With the puppy photo, 53%. With the family photo, 48%. With an elderly couple, 28%. Those with no photo, 14%. Second principle of persuasion, reciprocity. We repay in kind. People return favors. When we help people, they want to help us. This induces oxytocin, the brain chemical of connection and bonding. So an application here is to give what you want to receive. Your income is determined by how many people you serve and how well you serve them. When we believe, let me say that differently, when we actually behave in a certain way, such as cooperatively, someone will respond in kind. We try to repay in kind what that other person has provided us. It provides a sense of connection and closure. We have serious persuasive power immediately after someone thanks us. Of course, it's what partners do for each other. In a number of studies, reciprocity is so strong that it overwhelmed all other factors. In one study, success in selling raffle tickets was most effective for subjects who simply received a Coke. The feeling of wanting to reciprocate to the giver resulted in buying twice as many tickets as those who had not been given that prior favor. And think of the address labels you get as a gift with a request for donation. In one study, shoppers at a candy store made 42% more purchases when they received a gift piece of chocolate when they walked in the door. When reciprocity was meaningful and unexpected, the size of the tips that food servers receive was impacted. To diners offered a piece of chocolate at the end of their meals by the waitress, tips increased 3.3%. To diners invited to take two chocolates from the basket, tips increased 14.1%. In another scenario, after offering guests one chocolate from the basket, turning away, and unexpectedly returning to the table to offer a second chocolate, tips increased by 21.3%. Third principle of persuasion, social proof. We follow the lead of similar others, especially in ambiguous situations. When we're uncertain, we do things to see what other people are doing, and especially if they seem similar to us. So the application, provide a context to guide or demonstrate adaptive behavior. Social proof is a way we determine what's correct or popular or unacceptable, especially in situations we may not know nearly as much about. We find out what other people think about it. We even view behavior as more correct in a given situation if we see others performing it. In one study of donations to a street musician in Washington, D.C., researchers set two situations to observe the rate of the donation to the musician. Then, at another matched time, whenever someone was approaching the musician, one of the members of the study would drop some money in the hat of the street musician so that the approaching subject would see it. By viewing this act, it increased donation 8 times. In follow-up, not a single one of the people acknowledged being influenced by the other person donating money, how it had any effect on their actions. Instead, they came up with various rational reasons, such as liking the music. This means that basing influence strategies on what people acknowledge influences them can have a very high failure rate because people are often not consciously aware of what influences them or what they attribute in terms of cause and effect. Now, add specificity. A study in Great Britain found that the most remarkable success of getting people to pay delinquent taxes was the option that indicated the specific number of fellow citizens living in their zip code who are doing it. Social influence. Focus on behaviors that are frequently adopted and that are desirable. Social proof and other influence factors do have to be authentic and ethical, but they can be very powerful. That's why you see endorsements from well-known or notable or respected people. A fourth principle of persuasion, commitment and consistency. We have a deeply held motivation to behave consistently with a commitment we've made, especially those commitments that are made public to others. So the application here, write down and publicly declare a commitment. Then you're more likely to follow through. Think about how you end a coaching session. What would give you the most traction as a next step? Are you ready to commit to doing that before we meet next time? Here's a question I bet you've already considered. What can persuade someone to keep an initial appointment with you? Is there anything you can do that could have an impact on that? Well, I have a study in mind to raise the question, you might have guessed. A series of experiments were conducted at three busy doctor's offices where patients, immediately after being provided with a date and time in a standard appointment-making card, were asked to read back out loud those appointment details before hanging up the phone. This verbal commitment resulted in a significant increase in follow-through. Now, here's a variation that had an even greater effect. Instead of, or in a controlled study, divided up, matched patients in all the offices, for one group, the receptionist would do the usual thing, write down the date and time of the appointment on the appointment card, hand it to the patient. For the other half, she handed the patient the card and asked the patient to write down the date and the time. The result, those who wrote it down themselves had an 18% reduction in no-shows. This is a commitment that someone makes out loud to themselves, but it also puts it in an output channel in their brain, which completes the circuitry. A number of you heard me, the simplest study in this, University of Waterloo just recently had a study where two groups read the same passages from a book. One group read it out loud, the other group read it silently. They were both given a test. The ones who read it out loud did 40% better on the test. They put it in an output channel. So the best chance a commitment will be fulfilled is when there's ownership of it. There's less commitment when somebody else writes out the plan. So that's why we want to ask our clients, what do they commit to? What do they want to get done instead of instructing or guiding? We learn and remember best when we use an output channel, writing notes, talking about what we'll engage. In instances where it's not reasonable for the client to actively participate in this way, it can be more productive to get a response such as an email to simply check yes to confirm an agreement. This can enhance commitment rates. These are all ways to help people take ownership of their own stories, to use an output channel. And we all have a basic desire to be and appear consistent with what we have already done. Once we make a choice, we justify and rationalize that choice. We gather data to confirm it, a confirmation bias, and selectively omit data that may refute it, an inattention blindness. These internal and external pressures will cause us to respond in ways that justify our earlier decision. So we make our beliefs and perceptions consistent with what we've already decided. This principle of consistency is powerful enough to direct both our perception and our action. A desire for consistency is strong enough to be a central motivator and organizer of our behavior. Now, both mind and brain incline toward the continuation of the same, the default mode, status quo, no change. A body at rest tends to stay at rest, while a body in motion tends to stay in motion. So that's why we need to look at ways to overcome this inertia and make good choices more viable, more accessible, more doable. So a fifth principle of persuasion, authority. We defer to experts and those in authority. The authority principle is kind of an application of the halo effect. The application, expose your expertise. Don't assume it's self-evident. When you need someone to advance your case or product or service, having someone else, an agent or an advocate, can be very helpful. You're perceived as being more prestigious if someone is advocating for you. This is the idea behind book blurbs or endorsements from respected authorities. Here's an application. When you negotiate with an organization, first develop an internal champion within the organization who can provide information, who can advocate, and maybe even make introductions. And a sixth principle of persuasion, scarcity. We simply want more of what we we can have less of. People value things more when they perceive them to be scarce. Opportunities and objects seem more valuable to us if the availability is limited. So the application here may be to highlight unique benefits and exclusive information. G.K. Chesterton said, "The way to love anything is to realize it might be lost." Caitlin, my granddaughter, who was 4 at the time, was playing with a stuffed bear in her pre-kindergarten class. Sarah, her little buddy, suddenly decided she wanted to play with that bear as well. There were a lot of other toys around. There was no bear deficit, but Sarah was no longer satisfied until she had Caitlin's stuffed bear. Caitlin's mother, my daughter Lauren, a clinical psychologist, was rendered as helpless as Caitlin's absent granddad Dave in orchestrating her mastery to maintain possession of that coveted bear, or to work out a compromise for all-or-nothing 4-year-old possession-oriented minds. Caitlin will later learn how her own desires will be influenced by neuromarketing techniques based on celebrity induction, social valuation, and popular trending stuffed bears, even maybe the induced shortage of specific stuffed bears. But for now, she has only impromptu strategies to wrest the bear from the evil clutches of Sarah's immediate inspired desire. As all children do, they both had a radar for scarcity, the unequal distribution of wealth, tangible or emotional. Both girls were in the grips of the scarcity principle. When something becomes rare or scarce, it becomes more valuable. It enhances desire. When increasing scarcity interferes with our access to something, we react by wanting it even more. Later in their lives, Caitlin and Sarah will contend with marketing messages that are adult versions of the bear story. Limited number. Only 2 left. 1 day remaining. We're not making any more. Mimetic desire, one person's desire mimicking that of another, is not limited to children, but plays a significant role in product adoption of best-selling goods. Our neural system contributes to this contagion of desire. The more valued the person, the more attention we pay in that mirroring process. The scarcity principle involves a secondary source of persuasion. As opportunities become less available, we may lose freedom and choice, and we desire to preserve our established priorities. We need to couple not just what would be gained by acting or purchasing, but also what would be lost if someone else does not act or purchase. So when increasing scarcity interferes with our access to something, we'll react often by trying to possess the item more than before. A related tendency is to want what's been banned and to presume that it's more worthwhile when it's limited. Louis Neiser captured this when he said, "Some people will believe anything if you whisper it to them." Many years ago, here's a practical example that I had no clue of at the time. Many years ago, after I completed my subspecialty training in psychoanalysis, I was invited to join the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Institute. I was even more excited when I was also invited to offer a continuing education course in the evening for the professional community on any subject I chose. That was a plum at that time and in that context. I was warned, though, not to be disappointed if the enrollment was low, because the highest subscription for any course that had been offered to date was 7 people. The average was around 4 or 5 in kind of a seminar course. And occasionally, courses had to be dropped because there wasn't enough registration or no registration. So the first thing I did when announcing the course was to stipulate, in order to ensure optimum discussion, a maximum of 12 seats available. I was an optimist. I didn't know consciously at that time about the scarcity principle. In the first 2 days, 14 people signed up, and the waiting list grew. A brief overview of these six universal principles of persuasion that apply the mind and brain sciences. Liking and reciprocity highlight connectedness with others to generate positive association. Shared similarity, being together and acting together, creates a sense of unity which activates the hormone of connection, oxytocin. Social proof and authority both reduce uncertainty. Consistency and scarcity both motivate taking action. The most important thing in knowing and applying these persuasion principles is to be authentic, to genuinely have your client's best interests at heart. Remember that all influence factors have to be genuine, trustworthy, and ethical. Now, let's apply that in bringing this together to four primary tools of persuasion. One is relatedness and connection. For long-term impact, you must care about people and find a way to communicate that authentic feeling of caring and connection. Empathy is a listening perspective of resonating with someone else's experience, including, as we talked moments ago, feelings, perspective, ways of constructing meaning, that person's subjective reality that you're attempting to appreciate. Our ability to influence and persuade depends not only on our ability to empathically understand another person, but also to communicate that understanding. This is always a first step to empathically resonate with someone else to build a common ground of understanding. Everything else follows. Remember when I mentioned last time, state always comes first, then strategy and story. State is about this empathic connection. If you're not exactly right, the other person appreciates that you've attempted to understand, and they'll correct you. When you listen empathically and communicate that understanding, the other person feels truly heard. This is the essence of effectiveness, to be understood. The experience of connecting with another person releases oxytocin in the brain of both parties, further enhancing affiliation and trust. The more people trust one another, the greater the collaboration and shared information. So, remember the persuasion quiz done at Ohio State University? The option that is the generator of self-esteem, while the other four are only markers. The answer is the student's valued boost to their self-esteem, such as receiving good grades and compliments, more than the other four combined. The second tool of persuasion, autonomy. Having control over our environment and the choices we make generates the experience of effectiveness, of significance, to feel important and unique. When you understand what people believe and need, you can show them how your service or product will help them be effective to reach their goals and experience mastery. The third tool, certainty. The need to be certain that we can avoid pain and achieve pleasure is a basic human need. The brain is a pattern recognition machine that constantly tries to predict the near future. The act of creating a sense of certainty is rewarding. That's the most basic desire that we have as human beings, to be effective. Think about how we repeat patterns, listen to the same music, go back to places we've been, order the same food. We feel effective. There is a certainty with that of the outcome. Change generates uncertainty. Even a small amount of uncertainty cues the brain's error detection mechanism and contributes to our resistance of that change. We can increase certainty by making certain concepts tangible, such as goofy examples like how long a meeting will run, and explicit, such as the objectives. Much of the field of management addresses increasing a sense of certainty at times of change and transition, especially. And this is important. Whenever two people meet, The person with the greatest amount of confidence will influence the other. Confidence is a state of mind that infers certainty. It's contagious. Every state of mind is highly contagious, faster than the fastest virus. You know it. You sense it when you're with someone. These first three primary tools of persuasion comprise three of the basic six human needs: connection, autonomy, and certainty. Tools of persuasion. The fourth tool of persuasion, state management. Manage your emotions and states of mind. Focus is one of the two most powerful ways we regulate state of mind. The other is physiology, such as a deep breath. We determine someone's focus by the questions we ask. Asking a question is our most powerful tool to persuade someone. And the way we ask the question frames the answer. We're going to explore this a good deal more in our next seminar. So, just a word to close on the art and science of explanation. A natural inclination is to point to all the available information and a rationale for why people should pay attention to it. Yet, when a medical doctor prescribes a medication, just over 50% of the prescriptions are not filled. And of those that are filled, just over 50% are not taken as prescribed. So when someone consults an expert when they're motivated by pain and have to go through all it takes to do that, less than one in four actually follow that expert advice. Strategies that attempt to inform people into a desirable change have a high likelihood of failure. It is not information per se that leads people to make decisions. We all, to some degree, have to overcome the curse of knowledge. The difficulty we have in imagining what it's like to not know what we know. And the killer pairing is wanting to share all of what we know. I am afflicted by this. I know it well. One of the most profound challenges is to simplify. Although valuable, the knowledge we bring to the table, especially if we get into a teaching or an instructive or a training mode, will interfere with our ability to engage in conversation and to communicate in a brief, clear, succinct way. These following principles come from a number of neuroscience studies about how to heighten impact and retention. The four principles of good writing as well as good speaking: clarity, brevity, simplicity, humanity. When you speak to others, they're only going to be able to process and recall about 10 to 12 words before their attention and retention begins to slip a little bit. So consider the 10-10 principle. A collaborator and a buddy of mine, Mark Wallman, Loyola Marymount Executive MBA faculty, did research using the 10-10 principle. He had groups of people who were in emotionally charged situations, you know, divorce, arbitration. He had each side agree to hold their fists in front of them, raise one digit each time they said a word. When they ran out of digits, they stopped speaking. His research showed that charged situations, divorce, mediation, negotiation, arbitration, resolved faster, averaging 20 to 30% of the usual time that it took, and reached significantly more satisfying and complete conclusions. Clarity, brevity, simplicity. He describes this and some related aspects in his books, in his book, Words Can Change Your Brain. So here are just three or four other considerations to heighten impact and retention. Don't bury the lead. State in your first sentence what you most want to address. Then the benefits that you bring. Remember the hub statement. Most effective hub statements are 10 or 12 words. Listen carefully. Knowledge speaks, wisdom listens. reduce noise, include only what's simple and relevant, the essence of what you want to say. For example, if you ask a question, make it clear, specific, succinct. Then pause. Don't elaborate, explain, stack on another question, or do a multiple choice. And lastly, have fun. States of mind are contagious. My favorite grandmother said, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. So if you'll manage the background noise, we have a bit of time for comments, questions. What would be helpful to talk about? Anyone want to share, just in a succinct sentence or less, what you're hearing in this seminar that can make a difference for you in your practice when you apply it?
Hi, this is Jaden.
Jaden, go ahead, and then I'll come back to Jaden, please.
Sure. So I think one of the most important things you kind of touched on for me is that you can offer something of great value. You can the charge doesn't really matter, but if someone can access or get that value at any time, they might not jump on it. They might forget about it. So kind of combining it with the scarcity principle is really important for them to actually act on it, even if it's something they think they want but can have at any point in time.
Exactly, and that's a good takeaway, because we tend to want to revert back to our default mode of our comfort zone of not changing. So that's why, for example, if you have a conversation with someone and then at that moment offer them a time or a couple of times for a sample session, and you can nail the time then rather than waiting until someone calls you back or you recontact them, because every day means it gets a little bit colder, a little bit less likely to respond. Think about shipboard romance, things that seem, you know, so pressing and so center stage, then Monday morning when things cooled off, hey, it's, you know, that was a good memory. So we tend to revert to our default mode, and our default mode is not to do anything. So think about that, and that's a good application from what you said. There was someone to thank you for that, Jane. Someone else who also spoke. Go ahead, please.
So,
yes,
I
please.
Mean, knowing how much
can you get a little closer to your microphone or get off of speakerphone, because it's a little hard to hear you?
Sure. Sorry about that. Yeah.
That's way
so
better.
Knowing how much commonality we all have, it makes like the job even easier. Like, we all like are humans, and we have so much in common that we are able to relate even better to the person, and that can become even a mirror image. Like, I genuinely relate, not just going by script and telling the person, like, I know what you mean, I know what you're feeling, but you actually know. And with that being said, it's like who the person is who we are, too.
And that's a really important point, because that means that we are resonating with someone, understanding their situation, and responding contingently to them in a unique way with their situation from where they are. That person is the point of reference. So that's a really crucial point, yes. And that's why we want to understand what the primary challenge of the person is, because then once we've established that common ground, we can go to someplace new. So that may be even a good, you know, one possibility of response. When someone says, well, what do you do? No, one possibility is, what's the greatest challenge in your life or your business right now? That's exactly what I do. I'm a professional coach, and I help practicing professionals create strategies to achieve and sustain peak performance, or whatever you say. So beginning with where that person is, what their challenge is, people are only going to pay you for one thing, not for what you know. They can get all kind of information free. It's called Google. They'll pay you for one thing, that you can help them with something they can't do or be themselves that they see as important. That's all they'll pay you for. But they'll pay you very well for that. Any other quick additions, questions, or comments?
Thank you.
So, we will be talking about how to apply this both in recommendations that you make and what I want to offer, and I see some questions that are really excellent questions that I want to be sure we cover and really apply and illustrate. I'd like you to consider in our last seminar, this is our second and after our fourth seminar, to add on maybe 15 or 20 minutes just of discussion at the end just for a question and answer and discussion to be sure that we're covering everything. So to add that on to our regular time, if you're able to hang around, and we'll just have a discussion about things that we didn't get to or that you have a particular interest in. So thanks very much. Thanks again for all the responses, the questions you sent in. Take good care of yourselves. I look forward to picking up with you right here next time. Thanks so much. Bye now.
Thanks, Dave.
See you guys.